It's Friday, July 3rd, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a leading Hong Kong pro-democracy activist speaks out from exile against China's new security law in the enclave.
China is a growing giant country that pays no respect to the human rights of its people.
Plus, the murder trial of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi begins in Turkey. And the World Health Organization says there's very little risk of catching COVID-19 from cats and dogs. These stories and more are next. Our top story today. Authorities arrested more people in Hong Kong Friday after China imposed a harsh new security law. The law punishes secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison. Critics say the law stifles free speech and is aimed at crushing dissent and a long-running campaign for greater democracy. But pro-democracy protesters are finding creative ways to continue speaking out. Journalist Ria Mogul in Hong Kong has more.
It has been 3 days since the implementation of the national security laws, and we have seen multiple acts of defiance from the Hong Kong people, as well as much harsher crackdowns on Hong Kong protesters. The Hong Kong police today, in fact, brought their first charges under the law. This was against a 24-year-old man who had been charged with one count of inciting others for secession and one count of terrorist activity. The man was said to have driven his motorbike into a group of police officers on Wednesday during the protests, and his bike had a flag with a pro-democracy slogan written on it as well. The government actually called pro-democracy slogans secessionist and pro-independent. And because the offenses of the new laws are quite broad and the language of the law is quite vague, people aren't sure whether saying these out loud or whether writing them online would be considered to be illegal. The most serious law offenses carry punishments of life imprisonment. So Hong Kong people have been coming up with very creative alternative ways to express famous protest slogans, the most common being, and I quote, "Liberate Hong Kong, the revolution of our times." So what they've done is they've used these blocks to depict Chinese characters, and these images are being circulated on Twitter, on Telegram, on Facebook, on other social media apps. Another photo that has gone viral is this photograph of this woman that was marching down the streets on Wednesday during the protests. And she was actually holding up a blank sheet of paper with no text on it whatsoever. And her gesture, she told a reporter, was inspired by a joke that she once heard about the Soviet Union, where someone at the Red Square was distributing blank sheets of paper as well. So, you know, using their creativity, Hong Kong people are coming up with very interesting ways to defy some of these national security laws.
Thanks to journalist Ria Mogul in Hong Kong for that report. One of Hong Kong's leading democracy activists, Nathan Law, fled Hong Kong Thursday. On Friday, the 26-year-old spoke out for the first time since going into exile. He told Reuters news agency from an undisclosed location that he will continue his activism from abroad.
It is difficult for me to plan anything, given that the circumstance is so unstable. But I will definitely be vocal and active in the international level and deliver Hong Kong people's demands and their voices, given that they are unlikely to do so on the ground. So I will keep fighting with my much-needed position, and I hope that democracy and freedom will come to Hong Kong soon.
Law called on the international community to stand up to Chinese President Xi Jinping over his authoritarian rule and to start putting human rights above financial gain. The activist said the new national security law ends Hong Kong's one country, two systems principle. That principle, enshrined in the 1984 Sino-British Treaty, guaranteed Hong Kong's autonomy after the former British colony returned to Chinese sovereignty.
This is basically the end of one country, two system, because there is no more two system, no more firewall between the system in Hong Kong and China, and it's basically merged with the implementation of the national security law. So I think the international community should recognize that and adopt a relevant mechanism to hold China accountable.
Hong Kong and Beijing officials say the new law is vital to plug holes in national security defenses exposed by the protests. China has repeatedly told Western powers to stop meddling in Hong Kong's affairs. Law said businesses and professionals are considering leaving Hong Kong, once ranked as Asia's top financial hub, due to China's crackdown.
China is a growing giant country that pays no respect to the human rights of its people. So I think the future is grim. But I think for the past year, we saw the unity of Hong Kong people and we saw changes. And seeing such a large amount of people sharing the same values with you and conquering all the difficulties, supporting the values that they treasure with high price. And that is something that makes you feel hopeful, even though there's like a spark in the darkest time.
The exiled activist said the resistance would continue.
The demonstration on 1st of July, which was the first day of the implementation of the national security law, actually encouraged a lot of Hong Kong people. There were hundreds of thousands of people marching down the street, regardless of the risk of being sentenced for years of imprisonment. And they chant a slogan and they stood in solidarity. So I think there is certain tenacity inside Hong Kong democratic movement, regardless of the how large the suppression is.
He also had a message for Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Well, it's better for you to step down. It's time for a leader for the country who knows how to treat its people good and how to lead their country to a more healthy and positive way instead of just messing up the whole country. So I think that is the message that we should deliver.
Law is not the only exiled activist. As more people flee Hong Kong, pro-democracy activists are discussing a plan to create an unofficial parliament in exile. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
Pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong are discussing a plan to create an unofficial parliament in exile to send a message to China that freedom cannot be crushed, according to campaigner Simon Cheng. Cheng spoke to Reuters in an exclusive interview in London while tensions flared back in Hong Kong. More than 300 people were arrested in the former British colony on Wednesday, with police firing tear gas and water cannons. Protesters took to the streets again in defiance of sweeping new security legislation introduced by China, a law that punishes crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison. China denies interfering in Hong Kong and has warned foreign powers not to meddle in its affairs. For Cheng, back in London, the issue rings close to home. He's a Hong Kong citizen who worked for the British consulate there for almost 2 years until he fled after he said he was beaten and tortured by China's secret police. He has since been granted asylum by Britain and says another parliament could help keep democracy alive.
The shadow parliament can send the very clear signals to Beijing and Hong Kong authorities that actually the democracy need not to be based on the mercy of Beijing and need not to be complied with the constitution or order system, because the people are losing hope. So now we wanted to set up the non-official civic groups that truly reflect the voice of Hong Kong people.
He said the idea was still at an early stage and declined to say where the parliament might sit. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson offered some Hong Kong residents the path to British citizenship following China's imposition of the law. Cheng says he expects thousands of people will come. He called this a, quote, very good signal from the UK, but said one day they will be back in Hong Kong.
Thanks to Soraya Ali of Reuters for that report. As China seeks to exert authority over Hong Kong, Beijing also is facing off with India on its southwestern border. Border clashes last month between the two nuclear powers left 20 Indians dead and dozens injured, the worst military confrontation in over four decades between the Asian giants. On Friday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited a military base in India's Ladakh region bordering China, where the fighting took place, amid a massive Indian army buildup in the area. India also bans the popular Chinese-owned mobile app TikTok. The move derails a $1 billion India expansion plan of TikTok's owner, ByteDance. Megan Revelle of Reuters explains the spat between India and China.
TikTok was a viral sensation in India, but it's now banned and branded a security threat following India's deadly military skirmish with China. This is how an app known for goofy dance videos has become embroiled in a political spat between two nuclear-armed neighbors. In mid-June, 20 Indian soldiers were killed after hand-to-hand fighting with Chinese troops. Details of Chinese casualties are unclear. It happened in the Galwan Valley in the Western Himalayas, one point on a 2,500-mile-long contested border. India and China are the world's most populous countries, and both claim vast swathes of each other's territory. Some disagreements stem from colonial demarcations made when India was under British rule. India and China fought a brief war in 1962. A ceasefire line was drawn up, and there have been flare-ups ever since. Notably, a major border clash in 1967, resulting in hundreds of deaths. But the last major dispute was in 2017. So why the flare-up now? Well, one reason cited is that India has been building roads and airfields nearby. The Chinese side boasts superior infrastructure, and India wants to catch up. The June incident caused protests across India and increased scrutiny of Chinese imports. But the government's strongest move yet has been to ban nearly five dozen apps, including TikTok. The app is owned by Chinese parent ByteDance, which had a $1 billion Indian expansion in the pipeline. India is TikTok's top growth market, accounting for 30% of its global downloads. It provided a window into fame and fortune for many. Unlike Facebook and Twitter, TikTok resonated not only in cities, but in India's hinterland as well. Users ranged from remote villagers to top Bollywood stars. But growth ambitions have been derailed after it was branded a security threat. It's not the first time. TikTok was banned briefly last year after a state court said it encouraged pornography. Experts say an overturning of the current ban is slim, however, given that it's on national security grounds.
That was Megan Revelle of Reuters. At least 32 civilians, including women and children, were killed in central Mali's Mopti region when unidentified armed men on motorbikes launched simultaneous attacks on four ethnic Dogon farming villages Wednesday, local authorities said. Alaye Gwindo, the mayor of the municipality of Bankas, told VOA's Bambara service that the attackers arrived on pickup trucks, three-wheelers, and motorcycles. He said the dozos, or hunters, in the Dogon communities tried to defend the villagers and suffered heavy losses. The Malian army arrived after the attacks ended. The Mopti region has seen dozens of tit-for-tat ethnic massacres as well as jihadist raids over the past few years. Botswana says it is investigating the deaths of 275 elephants whose carcasses have been found in the Okavango Delta area of the southern African nation in recent weeks. The Department of Wildlife and National Parks said it is mobilizing personnel and aircraft to better understand the deaths. Poaching and anthrax poisoning have both been ruled out as the cause. Tissue samples have been collected for analysis at labs in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Canada. Botswana has the world's largest population of elephants, with more than 156,000 counted in a 2013 aerial survey. This is International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The United States remains the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. reported more than 55,000 new COVID-19 cases on Thursday, the largest daily increase any country has ever reported, according to a Reuters tally. Coronavirus cases are rising in 37 out of 50 U.S. states. Florida confirmed more than 10,000 new cases on Thursday, its largest daily spike and a level that exceeds single-day tallies from any European country at the height of the outbreak there. Britain will end coronavirus quarantines for people arriving from more than 50 countries, including Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, but not the United States. The move, effective July 10th, clears the way for millions of British tourists to take summer holidays without worrying about being quarantined when they return. Those arriving from higher-risk countries will still have to self-quarantine for 14 days. Cases in Japan rose to a two-month high, driven by the spread of the virus in the capital's night spots. Tokyo reported 124 new cases on Friday, up from 107 the day before, partly due to increased testing among nightlife workers. In New Zealand, Health Minister David Clark has resigned after recent controversies surrounding his handling of the COVID-19 crisis. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Border closures and strict lockdown measures have helped New Zealand contain COVID-19, and officials have said there was no evidence of community transmission. But David Clark has paid the price for his mistakes. The former health minister had admitted breaching travel restrictions when New Zealanders were ordered to stay at home. He was demoted from his position as an associate finance minister after breaking rules to take his family to the beach. Clark called himself an idiot after the breach. He was also criticised for failures to ensure that returning travellers were properly tested. In a high-profile case, two women were allowed to leave mandatory isolation early to visit a dying parent without being screened for the virus. They were later confirmed to have the disease. Clark says it's time to move on.
Serving as Minister of Health has been an absolute privilege, particularly through these extraordinary last few months. It's no secret that health is a challenging portfolio. I have given it my all. But it has become increasingly clear to me that my continuation in the role is distracting from the government's overall response to COVID-19 and the global pandemic.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said it was essential those leading the response to the pandemic had the confidence of the New Zealand people. The opposition National Party had been calling for Clark's resignation for weeks. A spokesperson said his handling of border quarantine measures had been utterly shambolic. The government ended most disease control restrictions last month. It had imposed some of the world's toughest lockdown measures. Its international borders remain closed. New Zealand is a South Pacific nation of about 5 million people. More than 400,000 COVID-19 tests have been carried out. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And the French Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, submitted his resignation Friday morning ahead of a cabinet reshuffle. His successor, Jean Castex, was named promptly after. Journalist Nicolas Pinault has more from Paris.
The announcement came as a minimalist press release. And I quote, Mr. Edouard Philippe submitted the resignation of the government to the President of the Republic, which the President Emmanuel Macron has accepted. This reshuffle is part of Macron's efforts to reset his presidency after the coronavirus crisis and comes in the wake of a disappointing result for the ruling party in local elections on Sunday. In that vote, the left-wing Green Party conquered some of France's biggest cities in the ballots, including Lyon and Bordeaux. Macron, who has pursued ambitious economic reforms since coming to office in 2017, has already admitted that the recession caused by the health crisis would require the government to shift tack. The new prime minister is Jean Castex, a career technocrat who designed France's response to COVID-19 and the lockdown measures. Castex will spend the next few days selecting his cabinet's members. Nicolas Pinault, VOA News, in Paris.
There is very little risk that pets can infect their owners with COVID-19, the chief scientist of the World Health Organization said on Thursday. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
The World Health Organization says it's okay to curl up on the couch and continue petting your furry friends with little worry of the coronavirus. On Thursday, the WHO again said there's very little risk that pets can infect their owners with COVID-19. Soumya Swaminathan, WHO's chief scientist, spoke on Thursday.
So there's very little risk from domestic animals because there was some concern about domestic animals becoming a source of infection. Some animals like the felines, the cats and the ferrets and even tigers that can get infection. So human to animal, but very little evidence of the reverse.
Vets across the globe have been trying to calm fears and again deliver clear advice to pet owners that animal-to-human transmission is extremely rare. At the Alfort National Veterinary School outside Paris, Director Renaud Tissier has also confirmed.
We have a message which is to repeat that there is no scientific evidence that in real life, in the way the disease is transmitted now, pets play a role. So they are not a danger. It's important to say that it is out of the question to abandon a pet because of a potential danger.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. A Turkish court put 20 Saudi officials on trial in absentia on Friday for the gruesome killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The killing sparked international outrage and tarnished the image of Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler. Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018 when he went there seeking papers for his marriage. Some Western governments, as well as U.S. intelligence officials, said they believed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing, an accusation Saudi officials deny. For more, I spoke to journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Well, this is the opening of the trial of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in October 2018 when he was visiting the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. 20 Saudi nationals are now standing trial for his murder, including Ahmed al-Asari, who's the deputy head of Saudi intelligence, and Saud al-Qahtani, who was a media advisor to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. These are two very close people to the Crown Prince, and those two men are facing the most serious charges of aggravated murder.
Now, was the trial open to the public?
This is a very much a public trial. There were journalists from around the world, including also diplomats. There was also UN official Agnes Callamard, who is the UN rapporteur who carried out a report into Khashoggi's murder. And also Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatideh Cengiz, who was waiting outside the consulate when Khashoggi was being murdered. So it was very much high profile. The Turkish government are very keen to make this very much an international event as part of their campaign to keep pressure on Saudi Arabia over the murder of Khashoggi.
And what has the reaction been to today's hearing?
I mean, there have been reactions at the end of the hearing, which has been adjourned until November. Agnes Callamard, the UN rapporteur, said there are limitations to this case because none of the defendants are present. She said that this is still an important process in keeping the quest for justice for Khashoggi going forward. And Hatideh Cengiz, the fiance of Khashoggi, said that her struggle will continue for justice both inside Turkey and internationally. So there is a determination to keep pressure on Riyadh and keep pressure on the international community to keep its pressure to bring those who were responsible for his murder to justice. Riyadh does counter. It says that they have carried out a prosecution, including five people were sentenced to death for Khashoggi's murder. They say that was part of a rogue operation. They were sentenced in December, but that case has been widely condemned internationally because even the identities of the perpetrators still hasn't been revealed, and it's unclear whether any sentence has actually been carried out.
It's a bit ironic that Turkey is leading the way on finding justice for Khashoggi because Turkey is heavily criticized for its own press freedom record. Is that correct?
Well, there has been very much broad support for this trial against those alleged to be responsible for Khashoggi's murder, and support in many ways for the tough stance UNGRA has taken against Saudi Arabia over the killing. A lot of people have also said there's a lot of hypocrisy here because you have to remember Turkey has one of the worst records for jailing of journalists in the world, although UNGRA insists that none of those journalists are in jail for journalist activities. Be that as it may, there is a great deal of, they feel, hypocrisy here that Turkey is trying to position this himself as a defender of a journalist, where at the same time many other journalists are being jailed. And in fact, in the same courthouse as this case was carried on, a number of human rights defenders were jailed for what international human rights groups say were absolutely spurious charges, including the founder of Turkey's Amnesty International branch, who was sentenced to over 6 years in jail. So this just underlines what many people see as the hypocrisy of Ankara's stance. Now, Ankara dismisses this, insists that this country is a rule of law, and this is why they are determined to bring Khashoggi's murderers to justice.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening, and have a